The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Right, so this was the catalyst for the development. We had been planning and thinking about how we were going to do this for some time, but it was a kind of back burner set of long-term ambitions. And then starting in December, I think, of 2013 and continuing for some of the most frustrating months of my professional life, every few days or every few hours, depending on when, the site would go down. So the answer to the question of what happened is I still don't know. You know, I made a decision at some point that the forensic process of figuring out what was going on was actually much less important than figuring out how to get it under control. And so there were two levels of attack. One was a relatively crude set of denial of service attacks that at some point escalated into more sophisticated and more distributed denial of service attacks. First, they were all coming from one server or one set of servers, and those were relatively easy to block. And then one day, I think in February of last year, all of a sudden it was coming from everywhere.
I'm Shane Harris of The Daily Beast, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, June 6, 2015. You know that voice. It's the guy who normally hosts the Lawfare Podcast, Lawfare's editor-in-chief, Benjamin Wittes. But today, I'm in the host's chair, and Ben is the guest on what is normally his own show. The reason? Lawfare is about to launch its new website, which will go live on Monday, and Ben and I sat down to chat about the new site, the cyber attacks and institutional growth that led to it, and how things will be different on Lawfare when you wake up Monday morning. Lawfare is almost 5 years old now, and this is the story of its growing up, told through a tech development project that is coming to fruition. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode number 126. Lawfare is dead. Long live Lawfare. Okay, so Ben, congratulations on the new site. And what are people going to find when they wake up on Monday and they visit Lawfare? That's new.
Well, so I think the best way to describe it is they're going to find a site that no longer looks like a blog, which is really the way Lawfare was imagined originally and the way it has lived structurally for its first 5 years. And they're going to find something that looks a lot more like a magazine. All the old content will still be there. All of our commentators, you know, the same people. But we have kind of outgrown the blog format. And so as we thought about what the new site should be, we had to think about an architecture that was going to support the very diverse both diverse subject matter-wise, but also diverse, you know, content style wise. There's a lot of video material, there's a lot of documents and archival material, there's we now host three different podcasts. And so Lawfare has sort of gone from a small blog where that reverse chronological diary format kind of worked just fine to something that was complicated enough that we really needed to think about how to prioritize content. And so what you're going to see when you look at it is, first of all, there's a front page that is much more like a newspaper or magazine, sort of more like the Daily Beast's front page or or the Washington Post's front page than it is like, you know, a blog.
Right.
And you're going to see that we have a lot of editorial control over how things appear on that front page, what materials and what content streams we feature. So, for example, sometimes you have a post that is, for example, last week Senator Whitehouse wrote a post for us. In the old blog format, that works like any other post. You know, it sits up at the top of the page for however long it takes until somebody else posts the next thing, and then it gets pushed down the page exactly as quickly as we add new content. On the new page, you know, we'll be able to decide, hey, that's something we want to feature for the next 24 hours and put it in a place where people will really notice it when they come to the page, irrespective of what else we might post in the meantime. But it also allows us to say, hey, what are the issues that are really big this week? Gosh, you know, this week everybody's talking about FISA 215 and the USA Freedom Act. So we would be able, in that context, to designate the surveillance feed or the FISA feed as particularly important, and that whole feed would show up featured on the front page. And there are a variety of places in which we kind of get to say, hey, here's what the readership wants from us in the context of what's going on this week. So it will, all the content will be the same. It will be organized completely differently.
So what you're describing is obviously it's a very flexible, much more like a publication than a blog would be. So when you started out doing this 5 years ago, did you imagine that this was the point that you wanted to get to? Or like what was Lawfare 5 years ago that worked fine for what you were doing? And then what changes that you have to now?
Okay, so to give you an idea of how far this was from anybody's imagination, when Jack and Bobby and I started Lawfare, first of all, we never imagined that it was going to be a publication that was anything more than a forum for incidental writing that kind of was either too technical for an op-ed or shorter than an op-ed or kind of didn't quite rise to the level that you would publish it somewhere else. I don't think any of us, I certainly didn't, ever imagined Lawfare as an institution that a community of people relied on every day as an information source, as a research tool, which was something that took us completely by surprise. About half of Lawfare's traffic is people searching for, material that is in the archive. To give you an idea of how...
That's an astonishingly high number.
Yes, actually. It's much, much higher than, you know, the average magazine. But, look, if you're a Justice Department lawyer, and I've had more than one tell me this, it's much easier to find Justice Department materials on Lawfare than it is to find Justice Department materials on the internal servers of the Justice Department.
Right.
So, you know, there is no place in the internal CIA servers that is as easy to find the material that we produce as it is. So people use Lawfare for all kinds of research purposes, both inside of government and inside the academy. There's also no database anywhere other than, you know, sort of Westlaw that has as much national security materials as we do in the form of documents, commentary, analysis. And there's actually important stuff that we collect on Lawfare that no other source collects, including places like Westlaw. For example, speeches. Some of the most important statements the Obama administration has made in the national security space take the form of speeches by people in government, you know, general counsels of agencies, the president, the, you know, counterterrorism advisor. These are not collected by the major law sources. And so if you're doing, you know, original research in national security law, what we've found is that Lawfare is almost the first place that people go And that actually, we felt, kind of created an obligation for us to build an architecture that could support the way people actually used it.
You know, one of the things that Lawfare did that I think that I remember as being sort of the first, I don't know if breakout is the right word, but that was distinct from anything you guys have been doing before and signaled a real kind of movement into being about original production, were the interviews you did out at NSA, where you and Bobby went out and you did these five, right?
Yep.
Long interviews with very senior NSA officials not long after the Snowden leaks had began. And, you know, so in the new instance of Lawfare and its representation, those things can, you know, they can live someplace on the front page and that kind of material can be called out and it kind of can showcase in a way that, you know, presumably those interviews could have gotten lost just in the sort of the downstream current that is a blog.
Right. And that was, you know, around that time, there were a series of events that took place that made us think about, boy, do we not have the architecture to support what we're actually doing. So one of them was that our traffic went through the roof. And we always imagined the site as serving a very small community of people in mostly in government. But it turned out that all the journalists were reading it. It turned out that all the scholars were using it for research. And it turned out, this was the part that really surprised me, that it actually had a general interest readership among lay people who were just interested in the subject. And all of these communities were using it entirely differently from one another. And then there were subgroups of the readership that were very particular. For example, Wells would go to cover the military commission's proceedings. And this had a readership of about, 200 people. But for those 200 mm-hmm. people, this coverage was the most important right. thing going on in the world.
Fanatically devoted. Yeah.
Fanatically devoted, to the point that at one point in the military commission's, the judge warned one of the witnesses who was coming back to finish testifying the next day, "You're not allowed to read Lawfare tonight." You know, and so there were these very specific communities that had nothing to do with one another, who, you know, were interested in very different things. And when you have all of that stuff in an unprioritized reverse chronological blog, it's very hard for people to find the things that they're looking for. And so what we tried to do was to create an architecture that made it very easy to A, navigate to the subject matters that you're interested in, B, find the content streams that are particularly interesting to you, and ignore the ones that aren't. Mm-hmm. And three, and this is really important, enable us to grow by creating subsidiary pages that are integrated with the site, but sort of thematically a little bit different. So the one we're going to launch Monday in conjunction with the site itself is a Middle East subsidiary page. And the theory behind it is that, A, there's a huge amount of what drives the Lawfare subject is events in the Middle East. And so we should have, you know, context and perspective on events in the Middle East that may not be pure law or pure national security law, but is really important contextually to anybody who's doing that stuff for a living. B, I happen to work in a building full of people who work on the Middle East, one of whom is my wife. But, you know, Brookings has an incredible group of people who do Middle East stuff that we can develop great content out of. And then C, there are other subjects. I think about privacy, where we do the national security law side of privacy. But like the Middle East, that's a corner of a much larger debate. Mm-hmm. And I want to have an architecture that we could have, you know, a privacy subsidiary page that looked very broadly at the subject in a fashion not specifically limited to national security law, but thematically related and important.
So these are all we've been talking about, events and evolution that really influence what the public, what the reader sees. And obviously there's a whole sort of systematic technical infrastructure behind this. And I remember one event or a series of events that also forced you guys to think about how you're going to evolve were a series of cyber attacks on the site. So talk about those, remind us what happened and sort of how that also influenced, you know, the development that we're seeing now.
Right. So this was the catalyst for the development. And we had been planning and thinking about how we were going to do this for some time, but it was a kind of back burner set of long-term ambitions. And then starting in December, I think, of 2013 and continuing for some of the most frustrating months of my professional life, every few days or every few hours, depending on when, the site would go down. And so the answer to the question of what happened is I still don't know. And, you know, I made a decision at some point that the forensic process of figuring out what was going on was actually much less important than figuring out how to get it under control. And so there were two levels of attack. One was a relatively crude set of denial of service attacks that at some point escalated into more sophisticated and more distributed denial of service attacks. First, they were all coming from one server or one set of servers, and those were relatively easy to block. And then one day, I think in February of last year, all of a sudden it was coming from everywhere. And that was very scary. So it turns out that there are good commercial services and some wonderful, actually, public-spirited activities by some large internet companies that stepped in and helped us get that stuff under control. The other side of it, which we've never really figured out, was that one day a whole bunch of content was missing from Lawfare. Mm. And there was significant evidence that there had been an intrusion, but there was also significant evidence that there had not been an intrusion. And, or at least there was reason to doubt whether there was an intrusion. We were able to restore all of the missing material, and I have never figured out in my own mind whether the right explanation was that there was an intrusion. It does seem to have coincided. It did coincide temporarily with the denial of service attacks. Figuring out who, if anyone, was in the system or to what extent it was a technical glitch is something, a set of technical glitches. We'll never know the answer to that question,
what
honestly.
What was the content that went missing?
So that was a series of... It was all posts by a particular writer. And not a particular writer who has enemies. So it wasn't like somebody said, I hate Jack Goldsmith, let's erase Jack Goldsmith from the face of Lawfare. It was a law student's post, vanished the same moment. And there were certain other reasons to believe that there had been intrusions, which I actually don't want to talk about. And to this day, I don't know. My best guess is that it probably was not a malicious attack. But I've never figured that out. And we had to take steps as though it were. Mm-hmm. And so that reinforced to me, that the person capable of managing Lawfare at a technical level is not me. And I have, you know, held it together because we didn't imagine it as a site that large numbers of people would be using. I kind of ran it myself at a technical level for the first, with help. I'm not a technical person, but for the first few years. And this was the moment at which I realized that whatever management we were going to have for it at a technical level, I had no place in that, and it needed to be done professionally. And so that was, at that point, a real wake-up call that we needed to fast, to sort of front burner the development of a new site that would be more resilient, that would not have me as its principal technical manager,
right.
And that was professionally developed so as to think through both the editorial and the security issues that we were dealing with.
So I think a lot of people who read Lawfare and who listen to the podcast know that you, before you were doing this, you were a journalist, you were a reporter, you wrote editorials for the Washington Post. And, you know, in the 5 years that you and Bobby and Jack have been doing Lawfare and Wells, too, and the team, you've been kind of, you know, in the midst of, as I have, too, as a professional journalist, this tremendous change and upheaval and, you know, blogs looking more like magazines and the distinction of what is journalism kind of blurring, but also in some cases coming back into sharper relief. And you know, talk about, like, where you were in 2010 versus now in terms of where you think Lawfare sits as a journalistic enterprise.
Right.
And do you see it that way?
Well, so it's a very interesting question, and it's one about which I have mixed feelings, honestly. So first of all, I have never really described Lawfare as journalism. And the reason I don't is that there are basic activities that any self-respecting journalist would do that we do not do.
Please don't say fact-checking.
No comment. We do fact-checking. I mean, we do in a serious way. There are, however, also things that we do that no self-respecting journalist would do. So let me give you an example of both of those. We have a policy that we don't publish classified material. And I have that policy for two reasons. One is that given who our readership is and the role we play in dialogue with them, it would be very hard for them to engage with us the way that we do if we did not have that policy. And that those NSA interviews are a good example of that. If we were publishing a whole lot of classified material, it would be hard to say to the senior leadership of NSA, why don't you sit down with us for an on-the-record set of, you know, interviews about everything you're going through that we're part of, from your point of view, the problem. So one element is just a kind of breach of faith with the readership and what the readership expects of us. But there's two other elements. One of them is that we are built to a very great extent on the back of student labor. And we have cultivated a generation of, you know, amazing national security law students who have come up through the site and have really helped build the site. And those kids do that stuff because they want to work in the field. And I can't have them handling classified material as they are getting ready to apply for security clearances or as they are thinking about jobs that might involve security clearances. And similarly, it's important that they be able to say when they apply for those jobs that, you know, hey, I worked for a publication that covers this area, but it's not normal national security journalism. The final reason, which is less pointed today than it was a few years ago, is that there were a series of base commanders in Iraq who were blocking all sites that were hosting WikiLeaked materials. And we had JAGs who were dependent on Lawfare who were writing to me saying, hey, we can't access Lawfare. And that's the funny thing is we weren't even hosting the material then. But it reinforced to me that it's much more important for us to have the dialogue with our readership that we do than it is for us to break classified news. So we just don't do that. And I think any self-respecting journalist would say that's not journalism. So I don't argue with that.
Right. But you've got readers that, I mean, you would presumably lose a significant portion of your readership if they could not come to the site because they've been told, do not go read things that have classified material.
Correct.
And that has happened. There have been people who have been instructed not to read articles on the New York Times that refer to Snowden documents.
Right. And we play a different role than, you know, a classic journalism outfit. So the other flip side is You know, we have a very simple conflicts of interest policy, which is we have conflicts of interest. And by the way, we don't always disclose them. And any journalist who did that would be properly drummed out of town. But I'm a Brookings scholar, and one of our jobs is to engage with the public policy process and quietly, you know, consult on things like legislation, on, you know, it's no particular secret that I've consulted with, you know, various government agencies on an informal basis on policy problems that they're facing.
You testify and before Congress?
I testify before Congress. That's the sort of public side of it. And by the way, there are private outfits that have reached out. And this is true of lots of our senior contributors. You know, we have people who are practicing lawyers who have clients. We have, so I think any journalism outfit that did what we do with the pretty explicit understanding, hey, we're going to always tell you the truth as we see it. But, you know, I don't promise that you're not going to learn that I'm involved in some of the public policy issues that we're writing about. And I disclose it whenever I can. But there are circumstances in which we're honor bound not to disclose things. And I don't make promises that like that, that I think, you know, people should be aware of when they read the site. And I make no apologies for that, but I would be appalled to learn if Washington Post journalists were doing that. And I never would have done that in my capacity as a Washington Post editorial.
If you were back in the Washington Post, you wouldn't do it either.
So I don't think of us in a classical sense as a journalism outfit. I think of it as Lawfare as a magazine, a publication, that produces very high quality analytic work product from a diverse group of political and analytical perspectives and disciplinary perspectives. I mean, we have, you know, people writing for the site who are technologists, people writing for the site who are lawyers, people. So it's not, you know, and that a lot of what we do will look like journalism, but that doesn't mean we have the same commitments that normal journalists have. And it also doesn't mean that we don't have other commitments that other journalists, that normal journalists would not have.
So you mentioned that contributors, and one of the things I've noticed that's been really, you know, gratifying as a journalist covering this who likes to try and get exposed to as many different viewpoints from smart people as I can, that you've got people like Bruce Schneier and Herb Lin and others who are writing for the site that certainly at the outset of Lawfare 5 years ago probably wouldn't have seemed like logical fits to have technologists and sort of, you know, even like activists and advocates writing for the site, but you sort of through the lens of what you're doing. So kind of like as a last question here, I guess, that's the first 5 years that have gotten you here. So what do you want the next 5 years of Lawfare to do?
It's a really interesting question, and it's one that we struggle with internally a lot as the site continues to grow. You know, part of the question is, what do you want it to grow into? And I think the core readership will always be the practicing national security lawyer. And we want Lawfare to be the one-stop shop for everything that person needs to do their job excellently. And the thing about Lawfare, the thing about that job, to be a really good national security lawyer, you need to know something about technology. And you need to know something about Yemen. And you need to know something about terrorist groups. I think you also need to know something about democracy advocacy in regions of the world in which, you know, we have choices of modes of engagement, right? Is the right way to think about Yemen as a place where we're going to conduct drone strikes or as a place where we're trying to build, you know, functioning governance, right? Or both. And so we want Lawfare to be the place where that user has the ability to get all of the information, all of the book reviews, all of the the audio entertainment slash education. Eventually, we'll probably do a lot of continuing legal education production. You know, there's a whole series of things that to serve that readership that I think much of which may have interest for people who aren't actually in that space, but who are interested in some of the same things that people in that space need to know about. And the answer to your question is, I don't know how big that makes Lawfare in terms of the numbers of readers, in terms of the penetration into a larger community. And I've sort of made a point of trying not to think too hard about it, but sort of think about it relentlessly from the point of view of what does our readership want from us and need from us and that we are in a position to provide.
Well, Ben, congratulations.
Thank you.
The site looks great.
I hope people enjoy the site and the new site, and I hope that I hope it will do for the readership in engaging with the site everything that a lot of thought has sort of aimed to make it do.
Great. Well, thanks for letting me come on your show and interview you.
Thanks for doing it.
Okay. The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Ben says it every week, but it's my turn. Share the Lawfare podcast, tweet the Lawfare podcast, review the Lawfare podcast, annoy your friends with irritating chatter about the Lawfare podcast. Our music is produced by the estimable Sophia Yan, the Edward Snowden of pianists, uploading data from Hong Kong. Thanks for listening.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.